This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever wondered if your furry friend might be partial to a beer or two? Did you know that koalas smoke pipes and dolphins get high on pufferfish? Here to tell us all about the weird and wonderful world of intoxicated animals and humans too is Oné Pagán, a university professor and researcher with a PhD in pharmacology with an emphasis on neurobiology from Cornell University. He writes in the popular science genre, which basically means that he writes stuff in a nice and accessible way so we can all understand and enjoy it. I loved his book. It's one of those where you get all these fascinating tidbits and funny information to share with friends and at parties. I can't think of a better party trick or opening line than, "Did you know dinosaurs used to get high?" Oné is a very lovely man, full of intellectual curiosity about life. The way he talks about all of it is intoxicating enough for you not to need any drugs to listen to this, so I would advise you do so soberly, as I imagine you have been doing so far. His book is called Drunk Flies and Stoned Dolphins, A Trip Through the World of Intoxication. And you can get it in all the normal places. You'll find a link in the show notes. Otherwise, follow him on @BaldScientist on Twitter. He has a podcast of the same name, the Bald Scientist Podcast. So find that on baldscientist.com. It's because he's a scientist and he's bald. Subscribe and give Oné some love. Hope you're all having a lovely festive season, by the way. I've been doing lots of interviews to line up the next few podcasts because I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks in Argentina. Well, I shouldn't give out my address in case there are any burglaries or the exact dates, so you shan't know either of those things. Plus, there's not very much to burgle, to be honest. But anyway, it's all very exciting. Lots of work at the moment to do. Thanks to all my new listeners for subscribing from Jordan Harbinger's, the episode I was on of his. Good to have you guys on board. I've already got loads of reviews from you guys and subscriptions and stuff. It's really, really helpful and supportive, and I love you all, mostly Americans, lots of Americans from over there. Very nice to have you with us. And I'll give shout outs to the new patrons who have signed up to my Patreon and Apple and YouTube at the end. Remember, you can get the bonus chat that we did, Oné and I, that is, as well as early access to ads-free full episodes on patreon.com/AndrewGold or through Apple subscriptions. Also, come join us for the video version of this video and all the other ones. They tend to premiere on Monday evenings, UK time, quite late in the UK. But that's always subject to change, so just check it out on youtube.com/AndrewGold1 or just typing On the Edge with Andrew Gold into YouTube and seeing what I've got lined up. That's all for now. Big guests are coming up in the next month or two. We should have Carl Zimmer, John Ronson, David Baddiel, Jordan Harbinger himself is coming on this show, and hopefully Amanda Knox as well. For now, it's the wonderful Oné Pagán.
How are you, man?
I'm good. Thank you for doing this. How's your day going?
So far, so good. No, thank you for inviting me. It was I'm beside myself happily.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. Well, I was looking for new guests, and I was looking down the lists of just new nonfiction books. That's how I look. And I saw your book, and I was like, oh, okay. This looks fascinating. And
thank you so much.
Oh, it's a great read as well. You've got a nice microphone there as well. Look at that.
Yeah, I have the thingy.
Oh, that's because cool.
Because I recently started doing my own podcast. It's called the Bold Scientist Podcast for obvious reasons. And that came about because of the pandemic, because I was teaching online. I felt stupid teaching to a computer. Okay, so it was the right thing to do, but I'm the kind of person who needs feedback. I tell stupid jokes in class to keep them awake, and these type of things. So that's why I have the good microphone. I already have a soft spot for you because my youngest son is called Andrew. So yeah.
What a beautiful, beautiful name.
Absolutely.
How old is he?
He's 20.
So did you think about Andres?
We thought about it, but my wife doesn't like the Spanish, Andres.
I lived in Colombia for some time before, and Andres had a different connotation there about menstruation. Andres, una vez por mes.
No, I didn't know that. In Puerto Rico, it's not like that, no.
That's Colombia for you. In Medellin, I lived there for some time. And it was when I said my name was Andres, because Andrew was a bit difficult for people, yeah. They were like, Andres, una vez por mes, like once a month.
So, oh, man. And I remember that you have Argentinian in-laws.
That's right. We're going there next month. Okay. She's going next week. My girlfriend is from Argentina. We've been together 7 years now. I lived in Buenos Aires for 6 or 7 years.
I've never been there. I've never been there.
One day. So you're from Puerto Rico?
I'm Puerto Rican, yes.
Okay, cool. And now you are in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I am.
Which sounds like Dracula to me.
a little bit. Actually, one of my coworkers graduated from Transylvania University.
Ah, well, there you go.
So many connections. Oh, speaking of connections, when did you go to the Jim Harrell's program?
Yeah, so that Jim Harrell was a paranormal podcast. I went on there, I think it was over a year ago, to talk about a documentary I made in Argentina about an exorcist. Who I think was quite abusive. I don't believe in the paranormal stuff. What have you done with him?
It's just that I've heard of him because we have a couple of common friends.
Ah, right.
I don't know if you heard about Micah Hanks. And he's like a journalist. He began like in the UFO paranormal stuff, but he's transitioning to more traditional journalism. And he actually, because I'm curious about those things. I'm a really healthy skeptic. Let's just say that I'm comfortable to know that we don't know everything about the universe, but I need evidence.
Yeah, you don't believe in vampires.
Oh, no.
Nah. The exorcist I met, he believed in vampires and obviously demons and stuff like that. Tell me, I've never heard the name One before. One Pagan.
Okay, so that, believe it or not, that's like a Greek name.
Huh.
Because my father's name was Onesimus.
Oh.
That's from the Bible. So his nickname was One. Huh. So when I was born, here I am.
One Jr.
One Jr., yeah. And Pagan, the last name Pagan, I read somewhere that, well, there was this lady from Spain. This is not a limerick, okay? So I once met a lady from Spain who says, well, Pagan is, I haven't heard that name in Spain. So I started doing a web search, and through some other people, it's from Scotland.
Oh, wow.
Go figure. There's still people with my last name in Glasgow.
Wow. Not with the, is there an accent? No,
Not with the accent. I suppose that a Scot went to Spain at some point, and then he went to Puerto Rico or something, like descendants. But it's funny. That will explain a lot. I mean, because I don't look like the stereotypical Latino, and I'm having fun with it.
Yeah. Can you do a Scottish accent?
I don't think so.
Scotland. My girlfriend loves it. Being Argentinian, she loves the Scottish accent. It's her favorite one. She doesn't like mine, so mine is boring for her. So tell me a little bit about your background and what led you to write such an interesting book.
Well, but first, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kindness. I mean, I was a non-traditional student. I've always wanted to be a scientist. And there was never any doubt that I will end up in something like this. I don't remember the story, but my mother tells me that when I was like 3 or 4 years old, I asked her whether God created microscopes. Okay. And that was a cute thing, but I don't remember. But she actually gave me a very good answer. She said, well, no, God didn't create microscopes, but he gave people the brains to figure things out and invent things. So I think that for a 3 or 4 year old, it's a good answer. So, but I like to say that I'm a mutant in my family. Nobody has ever shown any interest in academic science. And I always did. So anyway, I did my bachelor's in Puerto Rico in general sciences, general natural sciences. I took everything, genetics, astronomy, computer science, like a very general. So I couldn't commit. Okay. Then I started working and I found a technician's job at a medical school in Puerto Rico in the biochemistry department. When I was 35, a person who was a collaborator of my mentors in Puerto Rico came to the island. He was from Cornell University. And long story short, they recruited me to go to Ithaca, New York to do my PhD. And I did it in pharmacology with an emphasis on neurobiology. But the funny thing is that it was at 35. It's kind of past the age of that many people do it. And in fact, many people used to say, aren't you a little old to be doing a PhD? But I laughed at that because I actually thought about it and said, well, I'd rather be a 40-year-old guy with my PhD than without it. That's what I wanted to do. So, yeah. And I did. So 6 months before graduating my PhD, I was hired at Westchester University. So it's so many improbable series of events that it's really, I'm very grateful to life, God, the universe, everything. Regarding why I wrote the book, that's a direct consequence of my own research. Because I do research using an animal model that it's very unusual for pharmacology. I don't know if you've heard about planarian worms. They're flatworms.
Right.
So there's three varieties: marine flatworms, terrestrial flatworms, and freshwater flatworms. I worked with the freshwater worms. And I apply pharmacology to those worms. Now, they have a very interesting characteristic. Many species of freshwater flatworms, you can cut their heads off and they will regenerate their heads. They will not die. The head will regenerate a body. The body will regenerate a head. You can actually cut them in like 100 little pieces. And if you keep them, you know, safe, they eventually will regrow into full worms. The funny thing about the terrestrial flatworms is that they are able to pull that off even with their brains. And they have a relatively complex brain for an invertebrate, with many parallels to humans.
Wow.
So can you imagine if we learn how to do that? People with brain damage because of a car accident, for instance, or spinal cord injury, Alzheimer's, okay? So they don't only regenerate nervous system completely, but they do it in the right way.
What does that say for their lived experience? What do you imagine the mind experience of this worm? And then there's a second worm. What is it? Which one is it?
Well, they are essentially clones of each other. It's like having, when you have an identical twin, you have exactly the same genetic material. So it's going to be something, I imagine, because I mean, it's half of the time I don't know what I'm thinking, let alone what a worm is thinking. So that's a, but it has so many fascinating implications, not only scientific, but philosophical as well. So what I do with them is to study drugs, abuse drugs in them, to study addiction and to study toxicity of the drugs. For example, if you put nicotine in the water of the worms, you leave it for some time, you take the nicotine away, they go into withdrawal. They start swimming like crazy. They shake. They seek the drug. So, and we have taken advantage of that to try to come up with substances, discover substances that can potentially kick either addiction or toxicity of the worm. So we have published a few papers in the topic. But then when I got the science writing bug, the popular science writing bug, this is my third book, actually. The first one was titled The First Brain, was exactly about the neuroscience of planarians, because I argued that that was kind of the first bona fide brain, our style in nature. And that was published by Oxford University Press. I was very surprised because, when I submitted the proposal, of course, I was hopeful, but it was a really nice surprise.
You'll have noticed that my microphone audio has gone up in quality. That's because I've got a brand new Shure MV7 microphone. Now, a lot of you ask me all the time what I use, as you want to sound better in Zoom calls or start your own podcast, do some singing, la la la. This is me on my old microphone, the Uhuru, which is pretty good. And this is the difference with the Shure MV7. It's a proper piece of equipment and it lights up when I speak, which I like, and it gives you loads of options on the Shure Plus Motive app that it comes with. You can just leave it on auto settings if you're not that bothered about the exact sound. The MV7 that I'm using is a lot like the SM7B, the famous SM7B that I think Joe Rogan and other people like that use. But the MV7 can also be used with USB, so it's easier for amateurs like me. You just want to plug it into the laptop. You don't need, but it also has the XLR that professionals like to use. So that's the whole point of the MV7. It can be used by both. Click the link in the show notes to check it out and know that you can use my code ONTHEEDGE20, all capital letters, one word, for 20% off all products in the Shure UK online shop until July 31st, 2021. So that's shure.co.uk and ONTHEEDGE20, capitals, all one word, on Shure.co.uk, where they do all sorts of headphones and mics. It's a great deal. So the worms were the first, like evolutionarily, the first to develop a brain like ours. Is that what you're saying?
Similar to ours, yes. There's no direct lineage between planarians and us, but the morphology of it, like the two lobes in the brain, the neurotransmitters, they're very similar, pretty much the same. We have described the addictive processes, which can be used as a model. And some of the substances that we have tested in worms, they work on rats too. Okay, so there's a nice, actually one of them, I have it tattooed in my arm. I know your listeners cannot see it, but I'm showing it to you.
Yeah, that's ethanol or something.
No, it's called parthenon. <I'm> like,
what is it?
But we can talk about it later on.
Okay.
So, when I decided to write my third book, I thought about planarians and I knew that they could get addicted. I knew that they would be sensitive to this type of compounds. And I thought about some other animals and I started doing my research. I'm a bookworm. I love doing this type of thing. And I found so many things that I wasn't even aware about. And I just had to write a full book about it.
Oh man, it's so fascinating. I learned so much. It's one of those books, and I talk about these books sometimes on the podcast where I wake my girlfriend up and tell her, hey, did you know, the koalas smoke pipes?
That's my approach, the did you know question.
Yeah, well, you say at the beginning, you wrote at the beginning that you don't want to lecture people. It's an enjoyable book. It's fun and it's interesting and exciting to read. I'm just interested. I mean, you were saying you haven't thought about how a worm thinks, but I mean, have you thought about how animals think a little bit? And I remember hearing once in a lecture at university, and I studied English literature, so I don't know why this was even under discussion, but somebody was talking about how like humans are born with like 10% of the brain filled in and 90% left to learn. Oh, and then okay. Animals have like 90% there and they learn 10% more.
Oh, it's kind of the difference between instinct and learning.
Yeah.
Okay, that may be it. I'm not familiar with that hypothesis, but I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Well, so do you, I would just, I really, really, if I can do one thing before I die, I want to be able to experience the consciousness of a dog or something, or any animal, because for them to get drunk, and this led me to think about this a lot while reading your book, like what does that mean for like an animal to be drunk is it going like, oh, fucking hell, oh, you know, or is it just like, Well, have you given that much thought?
You know, you're not alone in wishing that. There's a few philosophers. I forget the name. He was a very famous one. I'm embarrassed that I don't remember his name, but he wrote an article about what would be like to feel like a bat.
Was it Wittgenstein?
No, doesn't ring a bell, no. But it'll come to me. What is it like to be a bat? Maybe we can find it. But the point is that we will never be able, well, as far as at the current level of understanding, I should say, we will never be able to feel exactly or to perceive the world exactly as some other organisms. I cannot imagine how it would be like to image the world by clicking my mouth and hearing the echoes that it generates. Because I'm sure in my office right now, there's a lot of echoes and a lot of things that I cannot perceive. Certain bees and certain insects, actually, and many birds, they can experience the electromagnetic spectrum, a fancy name for light, okay, in different wavelengths, ultraviolet, infrared. Certain rattlesnakes, they have specialized organs that they can actually image the warmth of their prey. So we cannot begin to imagine how it would be like that. Dolphins, they have actually an organ in their foreheads, actually very appropriately called a melon, and they can actually generate their echoes, that actually their sound waves that they use as echoes to image their environment. So we don't know how animals can, very drastically different from us, can perceive. That being said, the nervous system of all animals, they share many similar characteristics. If you take a nerve cell of a flatworm and a human and look at them under the microscope, to most of us, they would look identical. To me, they would look identical. Wow. There's no specialized nerve cells exclusively for worms or exclusively for humans. So all of us animals, they build different nervous systems with the same basic building block. And that is fascinating to me.
Does that suggest that, because people often talk about like aliens and UFOs and stuff, does it suggest that as far as we know, anything that's built, anything that grows in other planets and other solar systems is likely to be in some way similar to us?
Well, actually, that's an excellent question. And it may be the topic of something that I'm writing about. The point about it is that I, at some time, I published a paper in the, now I'm embarrassed. I don't remember the journal, but I'll send it to you. Let's just say the following. Any organism out there, anywhere, they should be able to perceive their environment. Okay? And in order to do so, they will need something at least analogous to a nervous system, right? So depending on their environment, such organisms should be able to perceive light or sound or smells, okay? So there's the idea of, in evolutionary sciences, of convergent evolution, similar solutions to the same problem. The most famous example is when we observe the very close similarities between a dolphin, a shark, and an ichthyosaur, an extinct reptile. Ah. Okay? So they all have torpedo-shaped bodies with flippers in strategic locations because they live in the same environment. And yet, one is a mammal, the second is a fish, the third is a reptile. Okay? So I think that if and when we discover life elsewhere, there will be many parallels. So, and I hope I get to see it.
Oh, I hope so too. Because people often say, "Oh, why do we assume they would be similar to things we know?" But maybe they would. I remember hearing a similar thing to what you just said. I think about the octopus and the eye, because I think the octopus is the furthest thing from us evolutionarily. Like if you go really far back, it went a different path and then still developed eyes, I think. Does that sound right? I might be half remembering.
It does. And the eyes are very similar morphologically than ours. There's certain differences, but for all intents and purposes, they function in the same way.
We were always going to develop eyes just like we did, or and any branch might do.
Something to detect light. Yeah. Not necessarily eyes as we do, but Some of them less efficient, some of them way more efficient. It depends on the evolutionary pressures.
It's so fascinating, these things in our heads. So tell me about dinosaurs. Do you think they were all like high on some drug grass stuff?
Well, that's kind of how I began the book. And I think they certainly would have the potential to become high or drunk on environmental substances. Then there's the matter of how much would they need. A normal human, about 200 pounds or so, can get in a relatively easy way high with reasonable amounts of substances. But a dinosaur because in my mind, organisms are entities. They're not it. They're a who. In my opinion. But I digress. I do that a lot. But a 100-ton dinosaur will need a prodigious amount of any drug to become high or drunk, in the case of alcohol, unless their physiology was so sensitive in a way that it's extremely different from ours, that they will get like that. But we will never know. That's a frustrating thing. I would love to see a T-Rex from a distance. We will never be able to.
It's interesting because I'm very tall. I'm 6'3", 6'4".
Oh, my God, how I envy you.
You say that. Somebody told me, you know, last night I met somebody who told me that, who was on the podcast before, another scientist called Dr. Stuart Faramond. And then it was one of the first times I met somebody who I interviewed on the podcast, because he lives near where I am. And he said the same thing, like, oh, I couldn't believe how tall you were. I hated it. Hated my whole childhood. Every photo you see, like my shoulders are hunched, you know, and I'm like trying to be small with the other guys. It just shows, doesn't it? No one's ever happy with what they have. It is what it is.
It is funny, and I'm going to give you a what you would think is an atypical example. And again, your listeners are not seeing us right now, but I'm bald, okay? Billiard ball bald. Okay?
I'm sorry for your loss. I'm very sorry for your loss.
No, it's okay. I love it. But I used to have curly hair. Very curly hair. My Andrew and my Reynaldo, we have two boys. Actually, we have three children. My daughter, she's the oldest, and two boys. They both have curly hair, and it came from me.
Oh. Unfortunately, that's quite ominous for the future of their hair.
Yeah, but it's okay. I mean, there's many jokes that I could say about that, but I won't do that.
Let me tell. So Reynaldo must be better at football or soccer than Andrew?
Actually, I see where you're going at. Actually, Reynaldo likes football as a fan a lot. And he always likes saying that his name is like Ronaldo.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's loads of there's like Rivaldo, Ronaldo. There was some other Ronaldinho. There was like all similar names. Was Andrew.
Ronald. It's the same root. Actually, Reynaldo is my middle name.
Oh, right. Okay, so there's the tradition aspect. I was just thinking, because as an Andrew, I know the us Andrews are typically not very good at sports, whereas somebody with a name like Reynaldo, it sounds like he must be better at sports. But you know,
he's a fan, that's for sure.
Tell me, how does... Oh, no, I was going to make a point before. Yeah, I'm very big and tall and whatever, but at one beer... And you said the same about yourself, actually, in the book, I think, that you're a bit of a lightweight. I'm a lightweight. One beer, I'm just like, blah, and then I have a headache the next day. Yep. So I guess that it's not just about size, is it?
It's genetics, too, because we all have our own. Well, let's just say it this way. We all have we all have the basic set of genes that define us as human. Okay. But then again, there's enough differences that extend to how we handle outside substances, including drugs, alcohol, nicotine, whatever. That's a reflection of the specific enzymes that metabolize compounds. Okay, people like you or me who get dizzy with a beer, that must be a reflection of certain genes that metabolize alcohol. But then there's people who can hold their liquor very easily. That must be a reflection of their genes, or they can get used to that too. Okay, so our physiology is very plastic.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Tell me, why does it benefit certain plants and things? And I remember you wrote as well that there's alcohol in space, there's alcohol in plants, there's drugs in plants. Why does it benefit them? Is it a poison thing?
Well, that you're very close. Actually, that's kind of the reason why most scientists think so. Because if you take a tobacco plant, it produces nicotine and a bunch of other things, but nicotine has no known function in the physiology of the tobacco plant. Okay, so what is it for? So the current understanding is that such psychoactive substances evolved initially as insecticides. Okay, so we have the tobacco plant produced nicotine, a bug began nibbling on it, the nicotine will overwhelm a certain neurotransmitter system, the bug will die, okay? But a human, which is much bigger, we go again to the size matter, which is much bigger, with the same amount of nicotine, the human will not die, but will experience certain psychoactive effects. Same thing with opiates, same thing with cocaine and other substances. So the main idea is that these plants evolved a wide variety of substances for defense.
So are we basically poisoning ourselves a very small bit at a time?
Yeah, slowly but steadily, yes.
So that's interesting. I mean, I had a guy called Paul Bloom, Professor Paul Bloom, recently, and he talks about, the science of suffering and like why we enjoy to suffer. So it feels like maybe that kind of suffering of nicotine or caffeine or cocaine or whatever is quite enjoyable to suffer, maybe.
It depends. There's a lot of things and to each his own. There's very different tastes in the world.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about some of the animals that self-medicate. I know you start with koalas, I think.
Yeah, that's probably the example that surprised me the most, at least it's in the top three, because when I started doing my research, I am an unapologetic Darwinophile. I love Charles Darwin and his work, okay? And I love evolutionary sciences, even though I'm not formally training that. My training is in pharmacology, biochemistry, and whatnot. But the point is that when I started researching about it, and I read that people wrote to Darwin saying, I have a pet koala and he steals the beer from me, or he stole my tobacco pipe and starts munching on it. Okay, so I associate koalas with cutely, like Winnie the Pooh, can I say Winnie the Pooh, type of things, But yes. that surprised me a lot. That's very surprising. A little far from mammals, there's two examples that actually surprised me when I learned about it. It's the fact that certain sea slugs can get amphetamine-induced hallucinations. I was not expecting that when I read that research. The whole story is that, well, some of the stories that sea slugs are some of the most beautiful animals in the ocean. That these specific ones are called nudibranchs. And for some reason, a group of scientists thought, well, amphetamines can induce hallucinations in humans. Why don't we try to induce hallucinations in a sea slug? Well, I'm one to talk because I do kind of the same thing with flatworms, but they actually did it in a very clever way. They observed that when these nudibranchs were touched, like pretending to be a predator or something like that, they will it will induce a type of behavioral response that they, it's almost like they will flip and swim away very fast.
Okay? Yeah.
It's a defensive mechanism.
Sure.
All right? When they gave amphetamine to this type of slugs without the physical stimulus, some of them still jump as if they were escaping from something. Okay? So they deduced that they were hallucinating, that they were being chased by a predator. They went further than that. They mapped the behavioral response that these slugs displayed into neurophysiological responses. They record the specific neurons where that triggered that response. Then they dissected the brains of the sea slugs and tested them in a petri dish. They gave them amphetamines just to the brains, and that induced the electrophysiological response that are correlated to hallucinations.
Wow.
Okay. who thinks about that?
Yeah, yeah.
That's one. The second example is about octopuses. Oh, I recently learned that you can say octopuses, octopi, and octoboats, and they're, accepted.
Okay.
I like saying octopi because it sounds cooler.
It does sound cool. And that was my next question. I have my questions all written here. And the next question was, what happens to the webs of drunk spiders and octopi on ecstasy?
Oh, okay. So let's talk about the octopi. So in general, octopi are curmudgeons. They're not social animals, with a couple of exceptions. Recently, somebody observed what appears to be like a cluster of social octopi, but there's not a lot of research about that. But in general, they are solitary. Even when mating, it's not a nice proposition for them, because sometimes either or both die in the process. Okay, so that's it. So for some reason, some scientists decided to give ecstasy to octopi, and they became mellower, they became more social, they became nicer, as it were, behaviorally. Okay, so that again, I mean, the example of the amphetamines in sea slugs, the example of ecstasy in octopi, and what we're going to talk about, the spider webs, that, again, it's evidence that links their nervous system to ours and validates the use of invertebrate organisms to study our own brains.
Wow.
Okay, so it's mind-boggling.
So they sort of, going back to my question at the beginning, and it is one I get a bit obsessed with, I suppose we can infer that they are sort of thinking in the same way as us a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, we can get, indications of more or less what they're thinking in the same way that we can observe another human, and based on their behavior, we can kind of figure out what they're thinking sometimes. It's reasonable.
That's extraordinary. What happens to the webs of drunk spiders?
Okay, so that's yet another story that began in the 1950s. There was this scientist who wanted to study abuse drugs. He was a physician and a pharmacologist. And he wanted to get like an indicator of when a person was intoxicated or when a person had toxicity, and he decided to use spiders for that. But then he recruited people of the zoology department to help him out, okay? And through a series of trial and error tests, they figured out how to give a variety of drugs to spiders And they actually, that the drugs induced different web making patterns on the spiders. And here I want to give a shout out to my wife, Elizabeth. She actually drew the spider webs illustration for my book.
Ah, lovely.
Yeah. So, and the point in this type of experiments is that drugs that affect reasoning or mind processes in humans, they affect the web-making ability of spiders. And this has been replicated once, time and again.
So they get hung over?
I suppose. I suppose, yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, and just think like, oh, what was I doing last night on the web?
Absolutely, yeah, I don't see why not.
Yeah. Wow, well, there you go. Are dolphins, I think you referenced them as, or described them as the most intelligent mammals on Earth. And I thought, aren't we more intelligent than dolphins?
Well, dolphins are undeniably intelligent, and they will display behaviors that are surprisingly human for good or bad. There's this misconception about dolphins, like I was born in the 60s, so I remember Flipper, the friendly dolphin, and whatnot. So and we have these misconceptions that dolphins are really nice and whatever, but no, they're just like us. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. Okay, so that's a given. And that was probably the most frustrating part of the book for me to write, because you read the book and you noticed that I tried to record and reference things fastidiously. Okay, that's part of my scientific training, because there's two reasons for that. I don't want anybody to think that I took the idea from someone. So if I write something, I document it. And second, I want to give the right information. Okay, so that's two things. In the case of the supposedly high dolphins, okay, there's no actual scientific research done on them. There's all of it is anecdotes. The thing is that a few years ago, there was a documentary crew filming a pod of dolphins underwater. And then they observed that they were passing to each other a pufferfish. And they didn't kill the pufferfish and eat it. They just nibbled on it and give it to the next dolphin and the next dolphin and so on and so forth. So, and they actually thought they were, that the dolphins looked high-ish, okay? So the thing is that pufferfish are famous for producing a very nasty toxin called tetrodotoxin, okay? And pufferfish is the main ingredient of this Japanese cuisine, fugu, okay? And people who like fugu, they like the tingling sensation that they feel in the lips and their tongue, which is induced partially by tetrodotoxin. When you go to the dentist and they put local anesthetic on you, you feel the same tingling initially. So it's the same type of nerve proteins to which tetrodotoxin binds to.
Right. Okay? Fascinating.
So what I think, this is an unapologetic speculation, and some people have thought about that too. There's two things. Maybe dolphins, again, by virtue of being much bigger than humans, they will not get poisoned by those amounts of tetrodotoxin, but rather they will only feel the tingling sensation in their mouths. They may like it, okay? Then again, their brain can have some differences from the brains in humans, and they can actually get high. We don't know. And there's undeniably some psychoactive effects of tetrodotoxin in humans. It's been documented.
There was a famous Simpsons episode. Did you see that?
I didn't see that one. I would love to see it.
It's a classic from the first few seasons. And I think it is fugu that Homer has, and then he's told he's going to die in 24 hours and he has to face his own mortality. It's quite a, it was funny, but it was quite serious as well. It was a very touching episode as well. It used to be quite poignant sometimes, some of the Simpsons episodes.
Yeah, I love Homer. I mean, he's a good dad, not too bright. He's bald. I can identify.
Yeah, you just need some jaundice or something and you'll have the right skin.
Yeah. I'm too pale for that.
Not yellow enough. No, man, it's really interesting. I think another thing I didn't know, and it's a bit, maybe it's a bit off topic, but koalas eat the excrement of their parents.
Yes, actually, yeah. And to humans, it would be a very gross thing, but you may be surprised that there's some, not exactly like that, but there's some such a thing as stool transplants nowadays.
Yeah, I heard of that. What does that mean? How can that be possible?
Okay, so what they do is that there's something called the microbiome. That's relatively recent. So it's the type and amount of different types of bacteria and microorganisms that it's typical of each human.
Okay? Oh, my God.
And that's becoming very interesting and very important for immunology, for general health and whatnot. So there's people with, for example, Crohn's disease, which is a very bad gastrointestinal series of symptoms. And there's been some success with stool transplants. Okay, they take the stool from healthy individuals, okay, and they transplant it not from the mouth, but from the other end, okay, to deceased people. And that seems to help in several occasions. Sometimes even with parasitic infections of hookworms, okay, that seems to benefit. I'm not advocating that anybody ingest hookworms or any type of parasite. Okay, if you have any questions, talk to your doctor. but it's been done with certain degree of success. But going back to the koalas, okay, it seems to be more or less the same strategy, because koalas feed virtually exclusively on eucalyptus leaves. Yeah. Okay. So it's a little bit like people who would drink. It's not exactly rubbing alcohol, but it's very close. Okay, which can be toxic. But for koalas, it's a matter of course. Okay. So it seems to be that the microbiome of koalas, it's kind of not transplanted, but inherited from mothers to the offspring in that way.
That's fascinating. I know quite a lot of people with Crohn's. It's quite common in the Jewish community for some reason. It's like a genetic for Jewish people get it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a weird... I think there are certain diseases like that, and it's particularly with Jewish people, they get Crohn's. And yeah, I guess if they ever need a transplant, that's easier than like a kidney, right, isn't it?
It's way easier than a kidney. Yeah, it doesn't involve surgery at all.
Huh. Okay, well, there you go. People, another fascinating, this is something else I had no idea about, right? That people can get, they have diseases where they just get drunk even without drinking alcohol. And I know you said this was on TV series now and stuff like that, but I've never ever heard of that. And somebody got done for drunk driving and was able to prove, they were four times over the limit, a woman, and she was able to prove that she actually just had this disease that made her drunk.
Yes, I didn't know about that until I began doing the research of the book. It's called autobrewery syndrome, okay? And it's not very clear what it comes from, but it's been actually documented that some people, particularly when they get a specific type of yeast infection, that's why we brew things using yeast and their biological machinery to get alcohol from grain and stuff like that. So some people, I wouldn't call it an ability, I would call it a curse, okay? That they will express or they will synthesize amounts of alcohol large enough to get themselves intoxicated without them drinking at all.
Wow, I've gone out of focus, by the way, I need to get...
Yeah, you're out of focus, yeah.
It happens sometimes, and then... There we go.
Okay. Yes, are you experimenting with substances? I'm just
if you saw me as out of focus, you're the one who is experimenting.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's the most incredible thing. And so yeah, tell me a little bit about that then. And I guess it's something we all know. So I'm going to have some beer or some wine or something. There's something called yeast involved in that. I don't know what yeast is. It's some sort of little animal thing. And it's turning stuff into alcohol.
It's a microorganism.
Right. So why does that do what it does?
Well, it's there's several hypotheses about that, but it seems to be also a defensive mechanism because it's a microorganism. And you know that when you go to the doctor and they want to put a shot on you or to take blood, they sterilize your skin with alcohol. Okay, so you kill microorganisms with alcohol. But yeast, at least certain species of yeast, yeast are microscopic fungi. Okay, so that's and they have evolved the ability to resist alcohol more than other organisms. So they can metabolize it. They can metabolize it more readily than other organisms, and they can actually produce it. And I like this thought, they can actually weaponize it against other microorganisms, because the current understanding is that they will produce alcohol in such amounts that will not kill themselves, but it will kill their enemies, as it were. Okay, so this goes to say that the idea of chemical warfare, I mean, as bad as it is in humans, we didn't invent it. We didn't invent it. Plants and microorganisms have been doing that for millions of years. And let's not even talk about venoms in animals, you know.
That's so fascinating. If we didn't have yeast, I mean, that's just a quirk of nature, that. I mean, if that didn't happen, that these yeast things produced alcohol, would we just not have alcohol? Would we not have beer and stuff?
There's more than one organism that actually is able to ferment. There's more than one species, I should say. But it must have been a serendipitous occurrence. Actually, in the book, I write like a funny imaginary tale about a cave person, okay?
Yes.
Who was very hungry. Actually, you have to credit my editor, Alexa, with his name. His name was Glarg, and I didn't come up with that. That was my editor. But the imaginary tale, because we will never know who was the first person who got drunk, or the first person who discovered that chewing on coca leaves could alleviate toothache. Okay? So we have, like, the 1600s people writing about that, but must have been millennia in the making. My imaginary idea is that this guy was very, very hungry, and he saw some fermenting grain, but he was hungry. It tastes horrible, but he ate it anyway. But then after that, after eating the fermented grain, he felt warm in a not unpleasant way. And then he or she began thinking, well, how can I feel this again? All right. And we know that people have been fermenting stuff for alcohol for at least 10,000 years or so, because when you go to archaeological diggings and you find old, really old pottery, and you analyze the residue of it, you can find that this is the same chemical substances that we find in beer or wine. Okay, so this is an ancient practice. And furthermore, some people think that the main organism that helped us do that was, of course, yeast, but was kind of inoculated by fruit flies in the material.
Is rotting fruit the same as fermented fruit?
Kind of. Fermenting is part of the rotting process.
So that's why it tastes quite tangy, you know, like fizzy when you eat.
It does, yeah.
And is that not, I always thought, often I'm thinking like on a plane, they give you the fruit and the fruit is a bit off and it has that tangy, sparkling, fizzy flavor.
Yeah, part of it is fermentation, yes.
So could you get drunk from that?
If in high enough amounts, conceivably. But all the other things that go on with the rotting process can be harmful too. You would have to, depending on the person, you would have to ingest quite a lot of fermented fruit to get drunk. But smaller animals, like actually fruit flies, the fruit flies that we were talking about, they can get drunk with fermented fruit. Did you know that male fruit flies, when they fail to get female companionship, they prefer fermented fruit as opposed to fresh fruit?
Because they're depressed.
Yeah, it's probably like you or I who got our hearts broken. Let's go have a beer.
Oh, man, I feel bad. If they have these kinds of feelings, I feel bad about killing them now.
I'm not alone. Why do you think I work with flatworms and not rats or, God forbid, monkeys in my research? No. That's not for me. I understand that animal research is necessary. Many of us are alive because of that. But I wouldn't. That's not for me.
It's difficult, isn't it? And I had a fruit fly problem where I was living before, just so many, and I didn't realize about the beers and stuff. So I was like cleaning up all the fruit and things like that and just leaving some bottles of beer like by the door, and then a few days later there were just a million of like depressed fruit flies swimming, like flying around. That do they get I think in your book you were saying they don't really, oh, they do feel it, they can't hold on to the top of glass as well.
There's a contraption that some people invented actually to separate them in populations for evolutionary studies. It's called the inebriometer. And there's different varieties of the inebriometer. And what they would do is that it's like a tube, a vertical glass tube with steps. And they will let loose a bunch of flies, and then they will infuse it with alcohol fumes. And again, some of the flies are going to drop immediately. And some of them will hold on for longer. And you can actually separate them in populations of the lightweights and the heavyweights, all the way up to the heavyweights.
And you were saying that's the real name of it, the inebriometer.
Yeah, it is the real name. I actually had the privilege of getting an illustration of the original inventor of the inebriometer. It's in the book, yeah.
Yes, I saw that. It's even in my Kindle, because I read it on the Kindle and I can see that. It was great. So tell me, I think we're near the end, and I just want to ask about just the thing, and it's something you touch on as well in the book. Is it chance that certain drugs became acceptable in society and certain ones didn't? So cocaine is not acceptable, but caffeine is. Is there a parallel universe where maybe caffeine is the sneaky one that they take at a club and cocaine is like you put in your coffee?
Yeah, probably, because... I mean, first, of course, I'm not advocating for anyone to use illegal drugs or otherwise. Also, I forgot to mention that even though we talk in jokingly terms about addiction, drunkenness, and whatnot, and I said that in the book, I mean, I'm not making fun of that, and neither are you, I'm sure. I mean, it's addiction and being drunk are horrible in our society, but we are using, at least I know that I'm using humor in my book in order to help people learn about these type of things. And that's a direct consequence of how I teach, because my day job is being a university professor. Okay. So my thing is pharmacology, and I teach majors in pharmacology and stuff like that. But I also teach about every semester up to 500 non-majors, non-science majors, in general biology, things like that. I get philosophy majors, finance majors, people who are not interested in biology at all. And I have to make it entertaining. Okay, so that part of my technique is to tell like a stupid joke or something like that. And I keep their attention in that.
Yeah, of course.
And that's how I try to write. Being respectful to the reader, but try to teach them as well. And my intent is not to lecture. So going back, and I digress a lot, I'm sorry, but back to the idea of legalizing drugs, the fact, some authors have argued that the fact that tobacco is accepted in today's society and coca plants are not, it's a historical accident of which one got to Europe first. That's a historical accident. Nowadays, we see a trend about legalizing cannabis, for instance, because, I mean, many of these substances that are illegal nowadays, they can be the basis of medications. Local anesthetics, the same ones that people use when they go to the dentist, they are chemical derivatives of cocaine, most of them. without the psychoactive effects. Okay? So the point that I'm trying to make is that we can take advantage of quote-unquote illegal drugs, study their mechanisms, study their chemistry, study their neurobiology, and we can obtain good, beneficial medications for us.
You wrote about how cocaine was initially in Coca-Cola, how, of course, heroin is used for morphine and stuff like that. You just get it out of the poppies. It's extraordinary. The only thing I think when I hear that is like, I've never smoked a cigarette actually, and never. And friends of mine, yeah. It's just horrible, isn't it? But friends of mine do, and they don't seem to change very much. Whereas cocaine, I have tried cocaine. I don't mind saying that because I'm not going to run for office for this politics. Okay. When I was a student at university many years ago.
It's not a sin.
It's awful though, because I felt awful afterwards. Just depressed and so low. And I feel like that's maybe one of the reasons as well, not just when it arrived, because cigarettes don't, apart the long-term problems are obviously documented. Yeah. But cocaine just seems a lot stronger. But is that just because people are more used to nicotine and stuff?
That's probably one of the reasons. Another reason is depending on the physiology of the person. It's really funny because in my case, I've never touched a cigarette. And I can't understand for the life of me why, because my mother used to smoke. And I never liked it. She got sometimes a little upset with me because I would throw her cigarettes away.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Yeah, I didn't like it. And I didn't like it for her. To this day, I still don't.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and then again, certainly I have some genes from my mother. But then again, it's something that... That's a taste I don't share.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Because caffeine, would that... Yeah, it's interesting to think of people going to a nightclub and being like, oh, I've got some caffeine. Do you want some of this?
Actually, there's precedent for that. And I gave a story. I think one of the kings of Prussia he was ranting about his soldiers drinking coffee. And the king was raised in beer. Beer is good. But that was like an economic thing because it was affecting the exports of beer from Prussia to benefit coffee. And again, there's societies where no substance whatsoever, it's allowed, okay? And for some people, the same amount of a certain substance can be a poison or something beneficial, okay? And let's not even talk about an allergy, okay? Most of us can benefit from antibiotics. And then there's people, if you give them penicillin, they will die because they're allergic.
That's
everything is a matter of perspective in a way. Again, there's undeniable. That's the undeniable reality that excess of anything, okay, can be harmful.
Yeah, you wrote that even water, like anything you have, too much of it, it will kill you.
Yes, absolutely.
What about air?
Pure oxygen is not good for you.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay, the percent of oxygen in the atmosphere is about 21%, and it's been documented that, for example, there used to give for premature babies oxygen, and that actually burned their retinas.
Oh my God!
Yes, and when they discovered that, they caused blindness in a bunch of kids. And nowadays, they don't give oxygen, pure oxygen, to revive children. So again, it's fascinating. It can be sad, but from the perspective of knowing what can be good, bad, or ugly, it's fascinating.
Well, wasn't that wonderful? I certainly learned a lot, not only about animals, but ourselves and our vices and our need to poison ourselves, oh so slightly. Hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. And if you did, make sure to get Drunk Flies and Stoned Dolphins in all the usual places. That's a book. I'm not insisting that you literally go and find Drunk Flies and Stoned Dolphins. And you probably can't, I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find both of those things in any one place in the world. If anyone does find any Drunk Flies and Stoned Dolphins in one place, do let me know, get in touch. But otherwise, just get on a Pagan's book. It's in all the usual places. It's in the show notes. Go to baldscientist.com as well. That's on his website, and get onto his Bald Scientist podcast. Thank you for continuing to listen to the On the Edge with Andrew Gold podcast. It's such a thrill to see those listening numbers going up and up. If you want to hear our bonus chat, sign up on patreon.com/AndrewGold or through simply subscribing to the membership on Apple Podcasts or on YouTube. It's about £3 or dollars or something a month, and you get bonus parts. On Apple, at least, you can do a free trial. The other ones you can just cancel after the first month anyway. Just listen to everything and cancel, then it's only a few quid. I can't see your names on Apple, the new subscribers, but thank you so, so much. It's a huge support. Get in touch to tell me that you signed up if you'd like, and if you'd like me to do a shout out or just to chat and say hi. I love when people get in touch. I'm on AndrewGold_OK on Twitter and Instagram. On YouTube memberships, thank you so much to Darby Costello for signing up there. On YouTube, it is the same as Apple and Patreon. It's just with the videos as well. Thanks regarding Patreon. Thank you to Kimberly, who I've been talking to on Instagram and is a lovely, very supportive person. Maureen Connors and Carrie Featherstone, both of whom have had lovely email exchanges and are also really, really supportive and nice. Thank you so much for your support. And come join us for the video premiere of this, even if you've already listened to this, which is typically Monday evenings UK time. But check out the youtube.com/AndrewGold1 page to see it. Many of you might be listening to this on that YouTube page now, going, I'm already here. Well, I'm chatting to you probably in the side as well as you say that. Meanwhile, please keep writing lovely reviews. I think that pushes me up in the charts and Apple. I'm not even sure. I read that it can help, and also can help if you unsubscribe and then resubscribe. Although I wouldn't want to push you to do that in case you forget to resubscribe. And I also don't know if I'd get in trouble for gaming the system. So you didn't hear it from me. But that seems to count as new subscribers for the week, and it pushes people up the rankings. I just saw somebody who rigged it and got to like number 4 of the whole Apple podcasts with a podcast that had very few listens, really. It's fascinating how it works and doesn't seem to be monitored as it should be. But I don't know. Thanks to the latest reviews, Maxi778 gave 5 stars and wrote, a must listen. I really enjoy this pod. I walk every day for about an hour or so, and I get so engrossed with the subject, I often keep walking until it ends, so I really like the longer interviews. Just hope that Maxi778 isn't near any cliffs or anything, and do keep looking out for where you're going. The review continues, a relaxing general chat to start, then peeling back the layers of the interviewee is a style that is engaging, yet not over-imposing, creating an interview that gets to the subject by asking really inquisitive questions. And I will often ask a question in my head, and then Andrew will ask it. I've gone right back to the beginning with the aim of listening to them all. Thanks, Andrew, and keep up the good work. Louis will say yes one day. Smiley face. I love that. That's a reference to Mr. Louis Theroux, who I think I said in one of the podcasts I was trying to get him on, and I couldn't get him on the podcast. At some point, I'm sure he will grace this podcast stage with his eminence. That's a good way to finish that prosaic line. What else? Big G's mum, that is, in the US, gave 5 stars as well and wrote, found your podcast after hearing your interview on the Jordan Harbinger show. I can't stop listening. I'm already into the 40s. I absolutely love your podcast and have recommended it to friends and co-workers. Several of us listen and then discuss your guests and the topics. Your interview style is refreshing and the topics are thought-provoking. Please keep up the good work. Wow. I wish I could reply to these reviews, so I hope that people listen this far into the episode. But 40 episodes already, because the Jordan Harbinger, at the time of talking, the Jordan Harbinger show, that episode of mine on his show only came out a few days earlier. So to get through 40 episodes already is extraordinary. I need to make these episodes longer or maybe even to do two episodes a week to satiate the desire of Big G's mum. Thank you very much for such a lovely review. Thanks again to Oné. Thanks to my sponsor, Shure. That is S-H-U-R-E. It's got an H in there that you might not have been sure about. Get all sorts of microphones and speaker things and technology. They're like the best in the industry. They're known as being the one to get from. If you want to start your own podcast, if you want to get a friend something for Christmas, remember On The Edge 20 is my, what is it? It's a code, isn't it? Capital letters On The Edge, all one word. 20 is still part of that word, but it is spelled with digits. Can you spell something with digits? I don't know. But that's it. On The Edge 20, capital letters, I'm sure. Coming up on the Edge with Andrew Gold podcast, are episodes with Carl Zimmer, John Ronson, David Baddiel, Amanda Knox, and many, many more. I'll see you then.